Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic movie review podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
Hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am too smart. I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm going to stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Visit us at ihatecritics.net. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handles there are Critics Pod. There you can participate in our top fives, watch the trailers, read the news we post, read reviews, listen to the podcast, whatever you want, interact. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. No matter where you listen to us, please go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate and review the show. We'll read your review on the air. And then Patreon. If you want to be a Patreon supporter and help grow the show, ihatecritics.net/Patreon is the best way to do so. If you're currently a Patreon supporter and your card is bad, please feel free to, or not bad, but if it expires and whatnot, be sure to check that here. And then I was actually going to my Patreon today and realized I was supporting people that don't do Patreon anymore. So they're getting like a free dollar from me every month. So I went and took that all away and moved it to one podcast. But yeah, Patreon really helps the podcast grow. So
yeah, I have a couple on Patreon that I'm supporting that definitely deserve it. Like Nathan Raymond, he's got a great Patreon. If you love his writing, Brad Jones, the Cinema Snob, terrific show on YouTube, and Allison Pregler, Movie Nights. I'm on Patreon for all of those because those are just that's just incredible movie content.
Yeah, I'm only supporting IVNV at the moment. I was supporting 8 other podcasts, but
I'm supporting no one since we're all listing what we're doing for charity.
We only did this to shame Josh.
I'll get on it now.
I only did it so people would want to support us. Sometimes if you see other people supporting stuff.
Right.
All right. Trailers, I guess. Should we start? Well, let's start with news. That's probably the more appropriate place to start.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dead people this week.
Yeah. It's that thing about threes, right? They come in threes.
A weird three.
Yeah. This is a weird three. Milos Forman passed away, 87 years old, one of the greatest directors of all time, 2 legit masterpieces, and a couple that are close. Obviously, Amadeus and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, two of the greatest movies I've ever seen. Amadeus, of course, is a big part of this show. It was such a revelation for me to watch that again when we did the 30th anniversary, and it occurred to me then just how much that shaped the way I see the world. Like the character of Salieri, I don't feel like I identify with him, but his perspective on that character is so fascinating, and it applies in so many different scenarios that it occurred to me watching it just how much that notion of what Salieri was and what he meant and how he was used in that film kind of shaped the way I kind of see the world in some ways. And of course, Cuckoo's Nest is just so amazing. There's no story. It's just these characters and some things that they do. There's no real story, but it's so riveting. These characters are so incredible. Nicholson gets a lot of credit, but the direction, the hands-off way that he handles these characters allows them the space to be who they are and to create these colorful areas is so smart. And the decisions that he makes are just so perfect. It is so precise and yet so loose. It's just such an incredible film. I would say that The People versus Larry Flint is close. It's been a while since I've seen it. It's a much more flawed than Amadeus or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but I mean it's such a fascinating story and a fascinating character that certainly Forman was fascinated by.
Yeah,
Yeah, I enjoyed Man on the Moon as well.
Yeah, Man on the Moon. Yes, absolutely.
And those are the only four of his that I can think of. Are there any others that I'm missing?
I mean, there's a lot of older stuff from back his foreign film days.
Okay.
That I've still got to go back and see. But yeah, his main American stuff is what I'm aware of.
If you've got a foursome that you get, like, that goes up against the greatest foursomes,
right?
Of all of the greatest filmmakers.
He was very selective. He wasn't out there just chucking out movies every once a year. He was very choosy about what he dedicated himself to.
He was very interesting in the Jim and Andy documentary.
Yeah.
The poor guy, unfortunately. But yeah, that alone was entertaining. And then, did you mention who else died?
Arlie Ermey, best known, of course, for Full Metal Jacket, and numerous character roles. But I would say that that film defined him as an actor and kind of defined his career. Really, he went on to play that character throughout his acting career.
It's one of the best characters that I can possibly think of for only being on screen for 20 minutes tops. There are so many good lines that I actually had a hard time picking out what was my favorite. I got to 10 and had to think, what is the one that most applies to me? What would be the one that would make the most sense to think of? It's an all-timer role, and he never really approached that from another angle, but he used that character and the way and how strong he was in that character to do a bunch of other things, even in jest, say, like on Family Guy or something like that. It's become part of pop culture, despite the fact that that film is so damn serious and what happens to his character is so such a shocking moment, but it's lasted throughout time, and he had fun with it too. He was a former Marine himself, as I understand. So
right, he wasn't even supposed to be in the movie. He was a consultant, and he made such an impression on Stanley Kubrick that Kubrick brought him into the movie and then expanded the role to where it gets to. That's just the impression that Arlie Ermey made on Kubrick as he was making the film, and it's to the point now, 30 years later, 30 some odd years later, that that film, that character has evolved in such a way where people forget that he was the villain.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's maybe primarily responsible also for me not really wanting to be in the military, thinking, well, if this is the way that it is,
right.
Granted, that's 1960 something in Vietnam War, but if that's the way that it is, then, yeah, I can't handle it. So there's not much of a point in me really trying to be a part of the Marines or the Army.
And that you're not alone in that experience.
Correct.
That said, I know someone on the other end of the experience.
For sure.
I don't know why.
And finally, this happened just hours before we recorded. Harry Anderson, who's best known for Night Court, passed away today. It's 65 years old. And it occurred to me as I was sitting here thinking about it, like, Night Court is not like an iconic show, but it lasted for a very long time. It was always a very silly show, and he was a very silly character. He was a judge who did magic tricks and was kind of the sort of Bugs Bunny character of that show, who was constantly got stuff going on, but he's always slipping through it. He was one of those characters, kind of like Hawkeye on MASH, when he had to turn it on and be serious for a moment. He had this like moral weight to him that would catch you off guard on that show. And I thought that's something that was made a deep impression on me growing up watching that show, was that those little moments where Judge Harry had to do something serious always had a little bit more weight, just because he was such a silly character, but he was also such a character that had a strong center.
And predominantly a TV actor. Also, Harry the Hat on Cheers made appearances from time to time. And every time he was there, it was a game of which way is he going to screw these characters over? And it was always a new thing. It's a very fascinating way to be creative like that. And also, he played Dave Barry, ostensibly, on a short-lived TV sitcom, and as a major fan of Dave Barry that I was, I did watch that show from time to time.
And people forget he was in the cast of It, the original TV movie It.
Yeah, and Milos Forman also did Hair. I guess that's another main one.
Sure.
That's the one with Beverly DeAngelis being naked, right? Okay. Wait, that totally makes the... You can even cut that from that better, but I always mess that one up with Hairspray.
She's been naked a couple times, as far as I know.
Really?
Vacation?
Oh, okay. Well,
or have you only watched it on TV or something?
This took a turn.
You know who else has been naked in movies?
I didn't mean to take over the obituary section.
Milos Forman that ends on, hey, Beverly D'Angelo was naked in that movie.
It was
just a side note.
Heartfelt. We had two people after him, so this is just kind of a footnote. We're fine.
Okay.
I'll feel the same way when Beverly D'Angelo passes away.
Right. And then Josh and I went to see Kevin and Smith, or Kevin. And Smith.
That too was a good show.
Kevin and Smith, wow.
For whatever reason, I was thinking Kevin and Bean, which is not even around here. I don't know why. Kevin Smith in Galesburg, and also his live podcast, Jay and Silent Bob Goodold. So two different shows. And going into it, I think I'm the only fan, or biggest fan easily, but probably also the only one. But it seemed like everybody who went with us enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. There were far more people there that I knew that I didn't see that night, but I did run into a couple of friends and whatnot, and it was far better than I could have possibly imagined. Anyone that's listened to the show knows that I have kind of a love-hate relationship with Kevin Smith, and the things that I really love of his, initially Chasing Amy and Mallrats, really enjoyed those. Clerks I didn't like, and... Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back didn't like, Tusk didn't like. I've kind of come around on a lot of his things, such as Clerks. I think that and Clerks too are really fantastic now, because I was looking at them throughout the prism of expectation and whatnot. And also I'm a little older, so some of it made a little more sense too. Maybe I have a better sense of humor too. I don't know. But in this particular case, he was actually very, very funny. And I didn't expect him to be that funny. I thought that he was going to talk about crap that he knew. The askewniverse has always been kind of annoying to me. And so I thought it was going to be a fan service type of thing. No, he has a genuine form as a storyteller. And he doesn't suffer from the same things that I do on this show, which is a lot of ums and ahs. You know, it's very... linear storytelling, and he may have his hiccups, as it was pointed out to me that night, but
and even
man,
then I wouldn't call those hiccups either.
I thought it was outstanding, especially a drawn out story about George Carlin and his relationship with him that I honestly didn't think much of before going into it. And then I realized, oh yeah, he's worked with George Carlin a number of times. That was a great story. I loved almost every minute of it. And the podcast itself, with Jason Mewes, he worries me because he's so jittery that it just kind of rubs me the wrong way. It's like too much. But in this case, for some reason, I feel like his annoyances were reined in. It's because the structure of the show makes it that we're on this topic now. We're on this topic now. And even the stuff where he's simulating sex scenes on stage, okay, it's very funny because he was reined in a little bit. I kind of dug the whole thing. I was very impressed.
I was very surprised by Mewes because I kind of like Jay and Silent Bob Goodold, but it does... A lot of it is so visual that you don't – it's not as funny when you're listening to him just make noises. When you're actually seeing what he's doing. And then the way he messes up so perfectly and Kevin catches him messing up, which he does in the podcast almost every episode. But almost like they plan it, but there's no way they could have planned that.
Boy, that sounds familiar.
But he – like the in Galesburg, the Ferris wheel was created there. Or the person who created the Ferris wheel is from Galesburg. And they were talking about that. You start spinning around in a circle. And Kels was like, no, that's not how it works. And he's going to add the town Kickapoo to his next movie. And
Shit Kicker, Illinois.
Shit Kicker, Illinois. And then he also, if anybody who's a I'm assuming you would know that he's not a big fan of taking his shirt off.
Right.
For the first time in probably since he was a teenager, he took his shirt off in front of somebody in Peoria to get a massage because the lady didn't speak English. And that became a huge story. He even told it on Hollywood Babylon Saturday night, the very next day. Oh, but yeah, it was a lot of fun. And he's going to be actually hanging out in the Quad Cities, or the Iowa City, Maquoketa, over the next couple weeks.
Well. Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing another one of these at the Angler in Iowa City, right?
He's doing Hollywood Babylon in one of these. Then he's going to that Codfish Hollow Barn and doing Evening With. And then we'll get to our trailers. We'll start with Hot Summer Nights.
I didn't see this one. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Which one?
The A24 one with the kid from.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I honestly was trying to think about this because he was in Lady Bird as a kid that was occasionally selling pot. Am I right about that?
Wasn't he in,
he was in Lady Bird, right? Timothy Chalamet?
Yeah.
Okay, and he was dealing weed in that movie, right?
I don't remember.
Okay, something told me that he was, and then this trailer, if you look it up on A24's page, it says, imagine Lady Bird star blah, 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 as a pot-dealing capitalistic entrepreneur. I said, oh, that's interesting. They're making like a prequel to Lady Bird or something. I don't think it's actually a prequel. I think it just works out really well that his character from that movie has some similarities to this one. I don't even remember what it's called. Something with summer?
Hot Summer Nights.
Hot Summer Nights. Okay. It looks very interesting. He's been in two movies that I've seen in the past year, and that's my first experience with this actor. He's really magnificent in both of them, especially, obviously, Call Me By Your Name. I'm on board 100%. It even has a bit of an 80s tinge to it, so all you have to say is 80s, and my ear perks up. So,
yeah, I wonder if it's even, I don't know. I kept thinking Trainspotting. It doesn't have the style that Trainspotting does, but it I feel like it's not really going to be about anything, but just kind of these kids living their life during this period of time, and yeah, that's kind of the movie's going
to
be.
Yeah, one summer where things get really intense to the point where you're running into major drug lords and stuff like that. Did I catch the actress from It Follows in the trailer as well? Because I haven't seen her since Independence Day Resurgence, and I was wondering if maybe that was the reason why.
I don't know even who the actress from It Follows is, so I wouldn't have noticed that.
Okay.
But maybe. Dark Crimes. Kim Carey.
Yeah. Really impressive, actually. There's something about Carey's face that actually sells this one in a way that I didn't expect. That ridiculous-looking beard. That look in his eye. He's got that. I was worried that this was going to be that number 23 movie that he made that was so bad, but he's got an intensity about him that kind of works for this. I'm kind of in on this one, especially I like the foreign setting that seems very odd for this. It seems like an odd choice, but this could work.
Yeah, I feel like you should probably say yours first before I go down on it.
I mean, the fact that it's coming out to DirecTV this weekend. Never mind.
I know that.
Then it goes VOD theater at the same time a month later. On top of that, they're telegraphing a twist, more or less, without saying it. So whatever it is, Jim Carrey is the guy, or Jim Carrey made it all up, or Jim Carrey did it. You know, that's what's going to happen at the end.
All that I needed to know was that Martin Sokas was involved as a villain-type character. It's standard. That's pretty much all he does. And Jim Carrey speaking Polish? Or Russian? I'm sorry, no. Not interested. It didn't convince me in the trailer, and I don't think that it will carry over to the film. And it's direct-to-video, and it's from 2016. I'm off board.
I didn't know the 2016 part, so that...
I didn't know much about it. I thought Jim Carrey seemed interesting in this idea, and it reminded me of something I'd seen out of Hungary, police procedural out of Hungary that I've seen a few years ago. It was really impressive. This looked a lot like that. I was wondering if there might even be a remake or something.
Hotel
Artemis. Sterling K. Brown from This Is Us making the move to the big screen with a big cast. Jodie Foster, and Dave Bautista as well. And this reminded me a lot of the John Wick universe. The Hotel Artemis is kind of reminiscent of something that that could exist in the John Wick universe, because they have a hotel in the John Wick universe that where hitmen stay, and they have all their amenities there, and it's a safe place for criminals to be, and you're not allowed to have guns and all that. And this seems kind of a similar idea, that only with a twist that it's a hospital. It's a secret criminal hospital where if you get shot during a crime or stabbed or whatever, you can go to this Hotel Artemis and they'll patch you up with the actual medical help. Jodie Foster is the head of the hospital. Sterling K. Brown is somebody who takes a friend there who's been hurt in a crime, and they've got some kind of secret that belongs to Jeff Goldblum. I'm interested if it's not just merely derivative of John Wick, if it can become its own more of its own thing. I'm in for this.
I actually thought that it was related to the John Wick product. In fact, at the end, I expected that they would say his name, or that somebody would say in the John Wick universe, mainly because your idea has come to fruition. I thought that it was going to be a TV show, though, and so when I saw this trailer, the same color palette, the same general attitude as John Wick films, I was thinking, for sure, this is related to it. But it doesn't give an indication of that. That being said, written and directed by Drew Pearce, has written a few scripts that we're aware of, including Iron Man 3. He's the writer of that. So you've got a Shane Black directing, writing tree a little bit. Okay, sure, why not?
Yeah, everything you guys said, with the fact that a lot could go wrong. Atomic Blonde.
It was right.
Another one that looked like a John Wick universe. I mean, this doesn't look as much, or that didn't look as much like a John Wick movie as this does.
Yeah.
But it's just with that cast, with that, I don't know, it was just a lot that could go wrong. But if they knock it out, but at the same time, you could hit a home run easily. Rampage. Speaking of going wrong or home runs, however you want to look at it.
Yes, Rampage, starring The Rock, sort of based on a video game, kind of. They've taken that name, at least, and something of that premise. The idea here is that Rock is a guy who works with apes. He's got a favorite ape named George, who gets exposed to a chemical that causes him to grow exponentially. He's not the only animal affected. There's also a giant wolf and a alligator, who they all get kind of morphed. They're made larger, but they also get it faster and smarter, I guess. There's a bad guy played by Malin Ackerman who's trying to get them to come to Chicago so she can kill them and harvest their DNA, I think, maybe. Not sure exactly what her plan is because it's so stupid. But the whole thing is really, really, really stupid. The only thing about it that works is The Rock, because The Rock can do pretty much anything. He's just that damn charismatic that I couldn't hate this movie. I can't hate Rampage because Rock is too damn entertaining. I think it's beyond silly, and for the most part, if it were any other actor, this could be one of the worst movies of 2018. But because it's The Rock, I'm almost borderline able to recommend this just because he's that good.
Man, I love this movie. In all of the right ways, I'm recognizing that there's nothing special about Rampage, except it bothers to give a little bit of time to a story. Okay, I mean, you didn't have to be a primatologist as well as a soldier who has a lot of training, but having a relationship.
What a lucky backstory, by the way.
Right.
But you can't take it away from the movie. It's the backstory.
It works. It adds a little bit of depth there that would otherwise not be found in, say, a Michael Bay film.
It has to be there because he needs that in order to make the plot work.
But it's there.
It's there. I'm going to both recognize its silliness and also really appreciate Dwayne Johnson as an action star. And appreciate the special effects of this film, especially George. I thought he looked fantastic most of the movie. The wolf was the one, Ralph the wolf, was slightly silly in the face from time to time, but the lizard was convincing. It also is very true to the escalation of the game. And the reason why I say this is when you're playing Rampage, it's like Grand Theft Auto in a way. You start bashing a few things and then, okay, well, that's an easy level. And then the next level, you've got helicopters coming in and doing things. Then the next level, you've got tanks. Then you've got the stealth bomber eventually flying over you. All of those things are in this movie. And so it has a little wink and nod to the most fun arcade game I've ever played. Rampage is by far my favorite arcade game. And so, yes, of course I wanted to see this. I had no idea it was coming out until that first trailer arrived. My excitement level is far beyond what it should be. And the movie, though, it isn't a disappointment. It is exactly what I hoped that it would be. It was fun, and Dwayne Johnson is charismatic. All of the ancillary things, like Jeffrey Dean Morgan is playing Texan to like the nth degree. he turns up his Texan to 11. And that is slightly annoying, but at least his character has an arc there.
He's really terrible.
There's two Watchmen are in this movie. That was kind of cool to watch, but you see the Warner Brothers greatest hits here, where they just slide in a bunch of actors that they work with a lot already. In that angle, I really enjoy this movie.
Yeah, and I thought the entire cast was in on the... I mean, they all seem to be playing with a wink towards the camera, and I appreciated that. They looked like they were having a ton of fun saying the most cheesy and random things.
That's the thing, though. It's like, does every line have to be exposition? Like, every line of this movie is exposition.
But you can
every
see.
Line of the movie is somebody introducing themselves or giving some piece of the next set of plot points.
Right, but you could see in the actor's face that they knew it was the stupidest thing they'd ever done, and that just made it more fun. I mean, I'm not gonna... This is just kind of a silly popcorn movie. You know, I'll take whatever that Jurassic Park movie was a couple years ago or last year, way better than this one.
No way.
Oh, hell yes.
No way.
Hell yes. And then some. And in fact, Chris Pratt could have done what The Rock did.
He did. Yeah, easy. Absolutely. I agree with that.
I wouldn't have believed that Chris Pratt would have taken all the damage that The Rock did here, though. That's the thing. He's such a tower of a man that this all works.
I think
perhaps what you guys are seeing in Rampage, what I see in Fast and Furious. I think that's what you're saying. I think it's silly, but it's silly in the most fun ways possible. That's my view of Fast and Furious. That's what you're seeing in Rampage.
It's possible. I was going to give this movie so much quarter that it might not have mattered if any person was in it. You know, I mean, if the animals just rampaged on and destroyed buildings for an hour and a half, I probably would have said, "Cool, I'll watch that." But they tried. And they tried, and like Bob said, everyone's on board, tried, that kind of thing. Everyone's taking it seriously and doing what I ask these types of things to do, which is try and raise the level of the source material a little bit, make it slightly more relevant than it should be. Transformers does not do that. And in terms of properties that are silly like this, that everyone's just crashing into buildings and creating a lot of destruction and mayhem and things that are otherwise terrifying, in that sense, Transformers is no fun at all, and I don't care about any of the characters. I do care about the characters in this, and I care about the action, and it looks good.
Now, let me ask you, as a Rampage fan, somebody pointed this out in a review that I was watching on YouTube, that not to take this thing to any level of seriousness, but in the game, it's human beings who turn into giant animals. And
yeah.
They pointed out that there might actually have been some stakes at the end if they were having to choose whether or not they were going to kill human beings as opposed to these giant, you know, just giant animals.
Of course. That might have, I don't know. There was already enough swearing in the film as it was, like taking it to that seriousness level, it becomes no fun then. You're like, yeah, I don't want to kill that person. I mean, I kind of liked them when they started out before they got to be a freak. But it makes slightly more sense, too, that an animal would have that kind of ability. You don't just take a human and turn them into a gorilla. That part of the game never made sense to me. But if you take something and mutate it, then I'm able to follow that a little.
Then it makes perfect sense.
No, I am able to follow that a little.
I know. I'm just... Yeah, and plus The Rock probably wants to be The Rock and not a giant ape or something like that, which is he would have to be one that turns, because...
Not necessarily, no.
It would be stupid if it wasn't him.
You can't cast The Rock then turn him into a giant gorilla. That
I know, but...
Sense.
Well, there's going to be a sequel, I hope. I mean, gee whiz.
You need to see The Rock. The Rock has that face that communicates so well, that body that communicates so well.
In the recent era of films, let's see, the past 2 months, we've got 3 video game films, if you count Ready Player One, as well as Tomb Raider and this one. And I can't help but recognize that I liked all 3 of them. And that's weird because most of the time video game films are really, really, really terrible.
If you'd asked me, though, like before they all came out, which one would be the best, I never would have said Tomb Raider. But Tomb Raider is the best of these 3.
I think you're probably the minority on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I do like Ready Player One, then Tomb Raider, then Rampage.
Tomb Raider is actually a little bit better than Ready Player One for me. I've been spending more time with Ready Player One, and it's not helping me.
That makes me feel better about my thoughts on Tomb Raider a little bit. That means you liked it a little bit, good.
Yeah.
But there are video game films that actually try and pay a little bit of attention to the fan service, too. I mean, I talked about Rampage's nods to the game. And also, if you guys remember playing Rampage in the arcade at all, or any games like this where usually it was just you in quarters, right? Unless you found a friend at the arcade that day, or your brother or sister or whatever came to play with you. I usually had my brother, who sucked at it. He was 3 years younger than me and couldn't do anything, so I'd always go and play by myself. And I think you got to choose which character, which I would always go with George or Ralph. I was never Lizzie, the lizard. This movie does an interesting thing by introducing George, then introducing the wolf, like... Oh, player 2. And then towards the end is when Lizzie the lizard comes in as a player 3. And you almost never got to player 3. There was never a third person coming in to join you for this arcade game. So you never got to see the lizard in the game, at least from my perspective. So I really dug that. It was like the movie wanted to go sequentially and follow my or perhaps many people's experience of playing this in the arcade. It's silly, but it's kind of fun that way.
Yeah.
Bringing back the actual fun of video games, as opposed to just trying to do something that translates more into a film, identifying what works well with the games, and then making that part of the movie.
Anything else on Rampage? All right, well, the next successful new movie that came out is called Truth or Dare.
Truth or Dare. Boy, this one makes Rampage look like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. this is a terrible movie. It's on par with, like, Maze Runner level bad. That's how bad this movie is. This is from director Jeff Wadlow, who ruined the Kick-Ass franchise with Kick-Ass 2. He's a bad director, and he just is not trying here. They basically come up with this idea of, you know, these awful characters are going to go on spring break and be awful people. They're going to play this truth or dare game that happens to be controlled by a fucking demon who sets about forcing them to play this game or die. And I was with the demon all the way. I wanted to see all these characters die. They're terrible people. The one character is like, she's opens the thing by saying that she's going to spend her spring break working with Habitat for Humanity. Then her friend gets her out of it by saying she's sick, and then she's on social media in Mexico posting everywhere pictures of herself. Like, is no one going to notice that? But the movie doesn't care about that shit. Because this movie doesn't give a damn about anything. It sets its stupid idiot plot in motion, and then just sets about, you know, using some bad special effects to either kill them or have them figure out a way to escape. There are two young actresses who at the very least are trying. Lucy Hale and Violet Bean have a moment late in the movie where you can actually see actual acting and you're actually kind of compelled. And then the idiot plot interrupts them again and they're forced into this ridiculous thing. They're forced to play along with this stupid movie. The thing about Truth or Dare is that it is a silly child's game, but I don't know if you've ever played with a group of friends, it is revealing of who your worst friends are. and who the worst people in your lives are. And that can be kind of interesting. There's a movie there where you just don't even bother with the supernatural bullshit, and you just have a group of people who really commit themselves to playing this game and to, like, some extreme honesty. And maybe you have something where you can study these characters in an interesting way, but you throw in this stupid demon bullshit and some jump scares, this thing is not worth the film that it was created with. Yes, Bob. I'm
trying to make truth or dare jokes. I feel like I've played it more as an adult than a kid.
You know what's really awesome is you talked about Jeff Wadlow.
Yeah.
Not only was he working on a script for an X-Men spinoff film, X-Force, which is probably going to take place after Deadpool 2 comes out. We know this from the trailers that they're already trying to do that. He was in charge of writing it, and he's no longer writing it, even though IMDb still lists him as writing it. He was also apparently interested in doing a Masters of the Universe film, and he had actually come up with an idea for it. And I saw in an interview this week he was talking about, well, it's too bad that Thor Ragnarok and Guardians of the Galaxy did what they did, because that's what he did with Masters of the Universe first. I'm like, you son of a... No, you did not. There's no way, just looking at what he's done before, that it would be congruent with that kind of quality. It might have had something along the ideas of fun, silly stuff, and they said they wanted me to make a fantasy film. I'm like, oh, because it's a fantasy film, probably, yeah.
He was going to do something lazy and silly, and probably stupid violent.
I haven't seen Kick-Ass 2, so I don't know the quality of that.
Awful. It's awful.
It's definitely very many steps down from Kick-Ass.
Very much so.
That said, he did make a movie that made $19 million in the opening weekend on a $3.5 million budget. So
he'll get work.
So he's a success. Isle of Dogs.
Yes, Isle of Dogs, the latest from Wes Anderson. The story goes that in Megasaki, Japan, there is an outbreak of some sort of dog flu, and the dogs are overrunning the population. And so to get... to take care of it, the dogs are sent to a garbage island, which is off the coast of Megasaki, and all dogs are sent there. We join a group of dogs led by Chief, played by Bryan Cranston, who's leading this group of formerly house pets as they try and scavenge for food. One day they see this prop plane flying over the garbage island, and it crashes, and on board is this little boy named Atari, who has come to the island searching for his dog, who's also his bodyguard, best friend. He's the son of the mayor of Megasaki, and he's gone against his father's wishes and gone to try and retrieve his dog. There's a whole family history of the mayor's family hating dogs, but they're kind of trying to keep that under the rug so they can get rid of dogs. They're very big cat people, apparently. And that's pretty much the plot. It's a quest to find this missing dog. It's good looking. It's mildly entertaining in that way that Wes Anderson can be mildly entertaining. It's more about the style. It's that got that kind of self-satisfied smugness that you know from a Wes Anderson movie. I liked this. I never laughed, but I didn't stop smiling, I guess. So that's something. It's amusing. I don't know if I don't know what else to ask of the movie that it was. That's what it was. It was amusing. I was not entertained. I just don't know why I don't have any more strong feelings about it. Maybe I'm not supposed to have any more strong feelings about it. The movie doesn't seem to have any real strong feelings of any kind. It sort of just tells the story very simply, very straightforward, with this very artful animation style. Beyond that, there's no core to it.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I know Josh.
No need for me to say a single thing. Your review is the most satisfying thing I've heard in weeks. I sat there. I mean, I watched it. And
oh, you went
I didn't
to it?
Laugh. No, I'm talking. I'm repeating his words, which are very satisfying.
It was amusing.
I was amused. Yeah, okay. That's a good way to spend an hour and a half of your life. Like,
I'd rather spend an hour and a half amused than annoyed. Like,
sure. I'm so very pleased with what you said. Thank you.
Beirut.
Beirut. John Hamm. This is weird. Why did this movie even come out? They barely promoted it. It played to so many empty screens this weekend. It's ridiculous. John Hamm stars as a guy who was a U.S. attaché in Syria prior to its downfall. Lebanon. Sorry, Beirut, Lebanon. His family is murdered, and he gives up on life and goes into a 10-year drunk. In 82, he gets called to go back to Beirut to try and negotiate the freedom of a CIA agent who was his best friend 10 years earlier. And the terrorist has requested specifically to speak to him. And there's a reason for that that dates back to when his family was murdered. Complicated story, relatively well told, and who the hell cares? There's nothing here that really – it doesn't have any kind of thing that tells you anything about the modern issues of Beirut or it doesn't really have anything that reflects on modern foreign policy. It doesn't have enough of its own suspense to carry it forward as a story on its own. And so without any kind of political underpinnings to make it relevant to today, this movie doesn't really have much going for it. John Hamm's good. Everybody in the movie is good, but there's just nothing that's special or particularly interesting about this movie.
Yeah, I didn't even know it was coming out until today when I was putting the show notes together. I'm like, oh, what the hell's this?
I watched it in front of an empty auditorium. Then I watched as other people, another person walked in and watched it by themselves because this thing was playing to almost no one because they did nothing to promote it.
I noticed that it's directed by Brad Anderson of The Machinist and Session 9, an interesting, if not kind of memorable film, and written by Tony Gilroy of Bourne, you know, and editor and reshooter of Rogue One. It seems like the kind of thing he would be interested in, though, like international espionage or international.
He might have
intrigue.
Given it a little bit more energy than this guy did.
Maybe his script did have it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic.
All right. Our undisputed classic this week is Friday the 13th, because Friday it was the 13th a couple days ago.
Yes. Was it 1980 this came out?
Yep. 81, something like that.
81. You know, this is an interesting film. If I wanted to, I could read something into this that's a little bit deeper. There's an element there about the values of the time versus the values of the killer's time kind of going at each other. There's also this, of course, the movie that really kind of sealed the idea of that trope about sort of the right-wing politics of horror movies, where if you have sex and do drugs, you die at the hands of the older generation. And certainly that's an interesting trope. It's the most interesting thing, I think, about Friday the 13th, other than the original killer not having a hockey mask, which people some history seems for a scene, right? Exactly. It's interesting. Like, there was a long time when I was among that group of people who thought that Jason was the killer all the time. And I mean, really, even the cover art still to this day seems to indicate that Jason is in this movie, and he's not. He's not in this movie. He doesn't, in fact, have his hockey mask until what, number 3?
Yeah.
It's fascinating, really, and history has just sort of changed and altered this in that way. It's almost like the Mandela effect when you think about it, the way that people have transposed the hockey mask Jason into this original Friday the 13th when he's not there.
Yeah, if you look at the cover art, there really is nothing on it that says Jason's in
right.
it, but you feel like there is.
Well, because what I'm thinking of is a shadowy figure behind a curtain with a backlit with the Crystal Lake and a machete.
But that's what he uses.
Yeah. And I think everything around this movie is more interesting than the actual movie. Like Kevin Bacon being in it, the, like I said, the sexual politics of it, the generational politics of it, the those uptight 50s values versus the sexual revolution values is interesting, but it's not well explored because the movie's more about the violent death than it is about any kind of point. I think Sean S. Cunningham would like to adopt that idea that his movie has meaning, but it's not Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That movie did have meaning. That movie did have a purpose at a point. I think everything that Tobe Hooper did in that movie was purposeful. I think Sean S. Cunningham was making a slasher movie that happened to have implications that he was maybe sort of aware of.
I think he was, from what I understand, they were just trying to make this so they get on to the next project.
Right.
And so that's why I agree with that statement. Josh, you look miserable.
Oh, I hate this movie so much. And I hate the whole franchise. But if nothing else, hype is the killer of this one for me. I came to it at age 26, I think. And that's way too late to have any interest in this at all. When other friends of mine, when I was growing up, were watching this at age 9, 10, 11, and really they were getting a chance to wear Halloween masks hockey masks at Halloween and dress as Freddy Krueger and Jason and whatnot. And I was like, yeah, I can't see that. They were experiencing this for what it should have been at that particular time, or even as teenagers, I could have maybe found some value in this. As an adult, I'm looking at the logic of this and finding it completely uninteresting. I'm trying to suspend disbelief too, because I know that it's just a slasher film, so I should let things happen. But then once you get to the end and it's not Jason killing people, then my mind immediately went to, no way that she was able to do some of these things. And it just bugged me.
How long in your life did you go on thinking that Jason was in number one?
Up until I saw the film.
When did you first see it?
Age 26.
Age 26.
So 2005. And around that time is when I had this horror channel as part of my cable arsenal. And we're talking about marathons of Halloween, marathons of Nightmare on Elm Street, and this. And I watched 7 of them to try and find a single redeeming value out of any of them. And this, of all 3 franchises that I've just mentioned, this is by far the most abhorrent of any of them. None of them have value to me. Jason is so indestructible, or the idea of Jason is so indestructible, and then coming out of the grave and everything like that. I mean, at least with Freddy, you're dealing with the science, I guess, of dreams, and you really don't understand that realm. So they can do whatever they want, okay? In this one, you're talking about the physical world. Even with reincarnation and lightning and all of that stuff, I guess I can at least get on board with that. But with Halloween, I'm still even more able to go with it as opposed to this one. And all of the characters, there's stupid characters in all of these films, okay? But this one has like the dumbest characters, and they're all saying completely inane things that I'm not interested in. Adrienne King, who plays Alice in this one. Yeah. There's no congruence between her and Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie Strode. Okay. There's nothing that you can compare them to except for the fact that they are the ones that take care of it supposedly at the end, you know, that's it.
And I think there's also a mercenary quality to this one that even Halloween doesn't have, where as this franchise goes on, they combine the Jason thing with the Carrie thing. Like, it becomes like a combination of Carrie versus Jason in one of the movies, and of course the 3D thing, and then the whole Jason goes to New York, Jason goes to hell, Jason versus Freddy. Even it becomes this mercenary gimmick as opposed to a movie.
When does he battle Carrie?
It's like a Carrie-like character. She has like the Carrie powers, mind powers, where she can like throw him against walls or try and drown him or stuff like that. Her dad comes back from the dead and drags him down into the lake at one point. Yeah.
Well, I know the ending's was stolen from Carrie, where Jason pops up at the end. I saw this in 6th or 7th grade. It was the very first horror movie I ever saw. I knew who Jason was. Kept waiting for Jason to pop up, which made it even that much better as a kid. Like, exactly what Josh said. I was the right age to see it, and no matter how bad it is, I hold on. It's that's the nostalgia thing. I just hold on to it for this movie. I don't know why, but this one I just kind of can give a free pass to for that very reason. And then just the fact that he's not in it kind of makes it fun, you know, as you show people when they get older or whatever.
I think it makes it better, certainly, than everything that came after it, for sure. There's no doubt about that.
It's not necessarily as fun, though, as some of the stuff that came after it, specifically Freddy versus Jason.
That is a fun movie. I do like that one. My cousin Jeff is a Jason expert, friend of the show. He used to refer to Mrs. Voorhees all the time, and I had no idea what he was talking about. Like, I just had no clue what he was talking about until years later when I realized, oh yeah, Jason's not in the original. It's Mrs. Voorhees who's the killer.
How old were you when Scream came out?
Oh gosh,
17.
You didn't see that either?
No, I saw that in the theater. That had
totally missed the fact when they say that Mrs. Voorhees is the killer, not Jason.
I wasn't paying much attention. I mean, that movie was actually like pay attention to the that got me. That's so much more artfully done than this, though, in terms of horror franchise and everything. And what I would really like Jeff to do is tell us exactly what he finds good about this. Help me see what he sees in all of these and give me something in each one to go off of. When I was watching all seven of them over a 2-day span, I found myself really intertwined with this literally could be this. This literally could be this. You were stating the gimmick in just different settings.
Yeah.
That is what I felt like. Like, I don't know if this is three that I'm watching right now or seven. And I gave up on it. And I didn't get to Freddy versus Jason. I'm sure that that's fun, you know, for what it might be.
You don't need to see other movies like that one.
I think, not to speak too much for Jeff, but I think knowing him, I think what he, part of what's appealing to him is this sort of campy subversiveness. It's certainly campy, especially the Mrs. Voorhees character is like one of these over the top characters, mm-hmm. and then so that has a certain appeal. But then it's also, you see it at a particular age, you see it when you're very young. It has a subversive quality because it is so violent and it is so bloody. You're not supposed to be watching this. That especially when he saw it very young, mm-hmm. that definitely hit him in that sweet spot of being something I'm not allowed to watch, but also has this weird campy vibe that's really over the top and makes an impression upon you.
And it's weird that the camp doesn't, it's not campy to a kid, but it's campy to a teenager or an adult, you know, just the way, I don't know, it twists on you, then you can appreciate the campiness when you get older if you, I don't know, it's just kind of...
I think I understand exactly what you're saying. Although I can't compare the two in terms of quality, I would like to obviate the fact that I saw Alien and Aliens at age 7, 8, around that time. It makes a lot of sense that it stuck with me then and has stuck with me since then as being the first thing that I really wasn't allowed to watch, but then I was allowed to watch it and I was told that, hey, if you're gonna do this, if we show you this, you have to stick with it. You can't turn your head or anything like that. So there's a lot of hype built up around that. If you're shown it as a child or as a... 10 years old, or as you said, Bob, I can understand why it would stick with you. You don't understand corny like you do at age 26. And this is for sure so corny that it was hard to watch. I know that it was remade, and I know that the remake is not received well, and they've tried to remake it yet again recently into a newer franchise, if I'm not mistaken, right?
But they can't get it off the ground.
They can't get it off the ground. Okay.
I've totally completely forgot about the remake. Was Mrs. Voorhees in that one?
No, they combined the first. Well, maybe she was, but I don't even remember. I just know that they combined the first.
Terrible.
He had a hockey mask on. So he was in it.
It's terrible. That's what I remember about the remake of being terrible.
But
it would have been ballsier to remake to actually remake the original. That would have a great deal more balls to it than we've got Jason, so we've got our marketing campaign.
Right. If I'm not mistaken, I believe a lot of the writers on this franchise also worked on the He-Man TV show. And if you really think about the He-Man TV show, a lot of the storylines are similar to some of them. They're just as bad and just as cheesy and silly.
Oh. My love for that has nothing to do with quality, mind you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to prove you wrong. I'm just saying. I watched something on one of the DVDs I had where they were just like, yeah, we wanted to do this in He-Man. They wouldn't let us, so we just did it with Jason. But with that, our top five is top five Friday the 13th movies. You have 12 to choose from.
And there's some wood outside that box, even.
What's your top five? Who's your top five?
Oh, yeah. Let's start with what Charlie Messing said. How can you ask someone to pick only five? It's like asking a father to choose between their kids. I have not figured out what Jason from New Mexico was doing. But I know he always has a reason behind it.
Yeah.
Number five, Happy Death Day. Four, Black Christmas. Three, My Cousin Vinny. Two, Cabin in the Woods. And one, The Expendables. He said, I'm sure I could do better, but this was enough work. My Cousin Vinny and Expendables just really, unless they all came out on a Friday the 13th, that's the only thing I can think of.
Maybe, yeah.
But Uncle Jeff did that, and he said, I'm going to choose movies that open on Friday the 13th. Five, American Hustle. Four, Saving Mr. Banks. Three, Spotlight. Two, 20th Century Women. And number one, Bridesmaids. Cousin Jeff. Number one, The Final Chapter. The second one is the original. Part number three is, I guess, part W.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one he's talking about there.
He meant part two or...
Yeah, maybe.
Well, W and V are right next to each other on the keyboard. Ah, he may have been going for V. It.
W and V are not next to each other. Number four, Freddy vs. Jason. Number five, Friday the 13th, part three. Josh Adams likes them in order.
Crickets.
I see it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He likes the first.
I see.
I had Freddy vs. Jason were 1, the original part 2 is number 2. The final chapter is 3, Jason Lives is 4, which Jason Lives came out before the final chapter. And then part 3.
I had number 5, Friday the 13th, part 3. Number 4 was Friday the 13th, part 6. Friday the 13th, Jason Goes to Hell. Or actually, I meant Jason X, not Jason Goes to Hell. Jason X is the one I meant to write. Because Jason X is the one where he goes to space. And that's got David Cronenberg in it. And it's got some really big laughs, whether they're intentional or not.
They have to be.
That fantastic ice death where he's... puts her face in liquid, whatever it is, and just smashes her to pieces. It's so freaking silly. I can't. And that Jason outfit at the end of Jason X is just hilarious. It's just that is some horror fans' wet dream right there. They just love that. So I dig that. Freddy versus Jason number 2, and I'll go with the original number 1.
1988.
Okay, well, there are 5 films on the docket. I got to one of them, and I know that I've watched one of them before. Return to Snowy River. It's a Disney film, and I know very little.
Oh, sorry. I heard the title, and I nodded off.
I think that's fair, because my memory of it is nothing more than there's wilderness, pleasant music, and an actor that I know the face of, which is, I think, Brian Dennehy. All right. It's a Disney film, so it's very gentle and pleasant, I'm sure. Not unlike, say, Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, or something along those lines.
I was forced to suffer through that movie. I don't know. It must have been. I don't know. It was awful. It was so terrible.
I believe you. It is Brian Dennehy. I got it right. A movie called Plain Clothes. Arliss Howard stars, trying to get revenge on his brother's murder. Barely made $300,000. I didn't watch it. The Moderns, starring Keith Carradine, Linda Fiorentino. A struggling artist is hired to forge paintings, causing him to cross paths with his ex-wife and powerful new husband. Made a couple million. Don't remember it at all, but people know Keith Carradine's face, yeah. I suppose.
Not good. Not a good movie.
Oh, you've seen it. I've seen it. See, this is... at least somebody's seen it. I like to try and cover all of them if possible.
It's not one of those softcore movies, but it's like it kind of has the feel. Like you can hear that awful saxophone in there. And Yeah.
Red Shoe Diaries without the red shoes. I see. All right. A film called Aria. I think that pretty much speaks for itself, but it seems to be, as I was reading up on it, a number of smaller films linked together that involve like dancing and the opera and things like that. Robert Altman directed one of the segments of this.
I believe Milos Forman did as well, actually.
How about that? I didn't see that in the explanation, but there you have it. Godard did as well. So that made only $1 million. Nobody was interested in it in 1988. I didn't know of it, but of course I see the word Aria and I'm like, oh, it's like going to be an opera or something. No, it's just an experimental type of film. And the one that I did watch, because I remember hearing about it then, I remember hearing about it in 1991, 1992, and it's a Sean Penn film that I hadn't seen. I've seen a good deal of his now, called Colors, and it's directed by Dennis Hopper, and it has to do with two cops, one older, played by Robert Duvall, one younger, the hothead, played by Sean Penn, wandering into the thick of the Los Angeles gang wars. And I like this film in many ways, in that it bothers to ask the questions of what actually causes, what are the gangs actually about, as opposed to a Hollywood film that would either glamorize the violence and not understand why it happens at all, or assume things about the gangs and make the cops heroes, per se. This film is asking, why are people like the way that, why are people the way that they are? And Robert Duvall attempts to forge relationships with the gang members. He isn't saying you can't do anything. He knows that things are going to happen. He's a realist, but he's saying tit for tat, you know, a quid pro quo. You do this for me, I do this for you. I'm largely going to leave you alone because I can't control the broad scope of the drug trade, but it's better if we all understand each other. Whereas Sean Penn is the hothead. He will take somebody, shove him up against the wall, and at one point in this film, in a disgusting moment, he spray paints the face of somebody that is defacing a wall. And this comes back on him big time, of course, because he thinks he's going to change the world through masculinity. I read a little bit about this film and that it was kind of blamed for igniting gang wars in Los Angeles between the Bloods and the Crips. Interesting. I can't say that that's proof at all. I mean, that it actually ignited things. I'm sure that, as I read, some gangs protested the film by saying they aren't going to see it. I don't know what good that would have done them. Sean Penn had a toilet bowl placed outside of his house, kind of like a, hey, just so you know, your movie's shit, I guess. Sean Penn was arrested on the set of Colors for assaulting an extra and spent a month in jail. So there's a lot going on with this particular film. And Dennis Hopper, having directed, he directed Easy Rider. Am I right about that? And that is such a hunk of garbage, despite the fact that it's well known and widely considered by many as a good film. I thought that was garbage. You can see some of Easy Rider in this, and that it's very handheld, very hands-on, digging into the depths of the underbelly of Los Angeles, and it's amateurish in that way. And it does, but on the flip side, it doesn't hit as hard as I thought it would. What I thought would happen at the end of this film does happen. And I saw it coming from a mile away. The film pretty much tells you that's what's going to happen. And so it doesn't leave me as maybe as affected as it should have. Have you seen it?
I really liked it. I saw it years ago, of course. This was my introduction to West Coast rap. The first time I realized like there was more than just Run DMC was listening to Ice-T do this song. And then finding out about others on the West Coast was pretty awesome and weird in Iowa and the Midwest in the late 80s. Fascinating movie. I thought Duvall is so great. He's just incredible, and he makes the whole movie better. Penn is good. It's kind of a typically hothead character that you kind of expect from him. Young Don Cheadle in there.
That's young Don cool. Cheadle, Glenn Plummer. It's like a veritable all-star team of people that you'll see in films later on, all playing hoodlums of one sort or another.
Real gang members were hired to protect the actors while they were in that area, in the gang-infested areas. And two of them were actually shot and killed during shooting of this movie. So if you're just in case you were wondering about the authenticity level of this film.
I kind of enjoyed the fact that it seemed to be guerrilla filmmaking to a certain extent, that he really is down in that area filming things. That made a lot of sense. It just didn't hit as hard at the end. Something of a typical story.
Well, that's pretty much the show. Next week we've got I Feel Pretty and Super Troopers 2 and maybe Traffic. Our classic's going to be Super Troopers, just, I don't know, it's an easy one. And people like that movie, so why not? And our top five will be Bad Cop movies. Yeah, that should be a fun week next week.
Bad, for some. Bad Cop movies. Bad Cop comedy movies. Just so we don't make an assumption about whether anybody likes Super Troopers or not. Not automatically throwing it into the bad cop movie,
right? Yeah,
genre.
It could very well be Training Day,
which is a good bad cop movie.
Sure,
define it how you want. But yeah, what else do we have? Patreon. If you want to be a Patreon supporter, IHateCritics.net/Patreon. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. Let's start with our key grip level in Charlie Messing. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effect level, Corey.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Seavers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
We're also subscribe on iTunes no matter where you listen to us. We're going to review the show. We'll read your review on the air. It'd be nice to kind of move back up the charts since we've gone back down a little bit. Am I forgetting anything else before we wrap it up? All right, well then, if you want to stick around for maybe a couple minutes, we might play Flick Chart.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three.
Spaceballs or Daredevil?
That's tough. Because I don't hate Daredevil the way most people do. But I like Spaceballs more.
Daredevil. The director's cut. It does make a difference. It becomes a rated R film then.
But it doesn't say director's cut. I haven't seen Daredevil. And I'm not... I'm just.
Affleck is da-bomb, yo.
Yeah, I like to keep him that way too.
At some point, once you halfway through that film, when Jennifer Garner's training and Evanescence is playing, that's when I'm checking out. But then a couple minutes later, I check back in.
Old school versus the Bourne Ultimatum.
Old school.
Bourne Ultimatum.
Old school.
I love Bourne Ultimatum. I do, but I like old school a lot more.
Underworld or A Beautiful Mind.
Anything other than Underworld. A Beautiful Mind. Did you hear, by the way, about the Russell Crowe auction?
No.
There was he's getting divorced, and he was auctioning off a bunch of stuff, and John Oliver, of all people, paid $7,000 for the jock that he wore in Cinderella Man just as a gag.
Boy, to have $7,000 to blow.
So how did he pay off this gag on the show?
He did it on his show.
That's when you just buy a jock from Walmart and say, hey, I paid $7,000 for this.
I don't know exactly the whole payoff. I just read the description of it, and I'm waiting to watch it later, but yeah, it's funny. I'm sure he's got a much funnier payoff for it.
All right, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1990 or Cinderella 1950?
Cinderella.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I kind of kind of a soft spot for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's not a movie. Blades of Glory, I guess that's... And then Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises.
I agree. Wayne's World 2 or Jerry Maguire.
Jerry Maguire.
Jerry Maguire.
Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, or Die Hard?
Die Hard.
Die Hard. All Die Hards.
The Jewel of the Nile, or I Know What You Did Last Summer?
Jewel of the Nile.
Jewel of the Nile.
Something versus High Fidelity. Starship Troopers or High Fidelity?
High Fidelity.
Flickchart is making it very easy tonight. High Fidelity.
Alice in Wonderland 2010 or The Avengers?
Avengers.
Avengers.
I'll take the Ralph Fiennes Avengers over that piece of crap.
Ooh, nice.
Batman Begins or What Women Want?
Which one is Batman Begins? I can never remember.
The first Bale movie.
Oh, yeah, that one then. Yeah.
Yes, that.
A League of Their Own or Lethal Weapon?
I like Lethal Weapon, but as a movie, I rather enjoy League of Their Own. Honestly, I don't know how to answer that one. Lethal Weapon for me. I guess Lethal Weapon.
Yes, that seals the deal.
Quarantine or Kingdom of Heaven?
They both really suck. Like, they are both truly epically shitty movies. I think maybe Quarantine is slightly less shitty for being cheaper.
There are a couple things in Quarantine that made me genuinely scared. Yeah. I'll go with that over Kingdom of Heaven, a Ridley Scott film.
I liked Wreck, the original movie.
Yeah.
Quarantine. I guess I'll go with that, but mainly because of Wreck. Shaun of the Dead or Romeo and Juliet, 1996.
Man, because I've never really loved Shaun of the Dead as much as I know most people love that movie. I don't. I prefer Baz Luhrmann and his style, honestly, so I'll take Romeo and Juliet.
A good portion of Romeo and Juliet is really fantastic, and then some of it is just, yeah, I'll still take that
over Shaun of the Dead. We're going to lose our fanboy cred.
I'll take Shaun of the Dead.
There you go.
Superman Returns or Blood Diamond?
Another choice between movies I just don't give a damn about.
This week is.
What were the choices again? Because I already forgot.
Superman Returns and Blood Diamond.
Blood Diamond?
Yeah. If you were telling me the trailer for Superman Returns or Blood Diamond, I would take the trailer for Superman Returns. But Blood Diamond's the better film.
Seabiscuit or Dead Poets Society?
Dead Poets
Society. Dead Poets.
Kingpin or the Goonies?
Kingpin.
Goonies.
Goonies.
Wow.
Bourne Identity or The Cabin in the Woods?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Those are two really good movies. Bourne.
I haven't seen Cabin in the Woods still. It's like one of the...
I'd go Cabin.
Yeah, you guys told me about it one of the first shows I was on, and that was almost 5 years ago now, and I still haven't seen it.
Army of Darkness or Sleepless in Seattle?
Army of Darkness.
Oh. I have to choose Sleepless in Seattle.
Wow.
It's Army of Darkness. Ooh. Well, it's easy, but Ghostbusters versus The Big Lebowski.
Oh, The Big Lebowski.
Lebowski.
Hard to ever pick against Ghostbusters, but obviously it's Lebowski. Backdraft or The Incredibles?
Incredibles.
Incredibles. I did forget to bring The Incredibles 2 trailer to the show this week. Maybe we'll throw it in next week.
All right, we can end on this one. Full Metal Jacket or The Talented Mr. Ripley?
Ooh.
That's difficult. That is really difficult, because I love both of those movies equally. Boy. Man, that is... Can somebody else go?
No, this is all for you because I don't like Talented Mr. Ripley, so it's easy for you. I knew that the ooh was for your choice.
Huh.
You don't like Talented Mr. Ripley?
No.
Oh, I think it's amazing.
Just because Arlie Ermey died, I'll pick Full Metal Jacket. I really don't know which one I like better, but...
Good, that'll be the choice then.
All right, game over.